I do want to welcome everyone, as was mentioned by our song leader, Mr. Irvin, to the first day of Unleavened Bread, an annual holy day that's ordained by God for the benefit of mankind. And we're gathered here today in holy convocation according to God's plan that's outlined in the Scriptures. We can read about that in Exodus 12, verse 14 through 20. In Exodus 12, verse 14 through 20, and I'm just going to paraphrase it, but start it and then paraphrase it. So this day, meaning Passover, shall be to you as a memorial, and you shall keep it as a feast to the Lord throughout your generations. Actually, this right after Passover. You shall keep it as a feast by an everlasting ordinance. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. First day you shall remove leaven from your houses, and so forth. And it comes down through verse 20, you shall eat nothing leavened in all your dwellings, and you shall eat unleavened bread. So this is a week that's set aside for us. And, of course, there's an expectation that we keep this feast of unleavened bread. It's outlined further in Exodus 23 in verses 4 through 8. And this, is a reminder of those days of unleavened bread and talking about the institution of Passover and setting forth of the days of unleavened bread, that 7 days you shall have for unleavened bread, and then the first and last is a convocation. Well, the Feast of Unleavened Bread is thousands of years old. It's entwined in the history of Israel and contains lessons for us individually to come out of personal sin, just as the people of Israel came out of Egypt, Egypt being a symbol of sin. So we're gathered here today in convocation as God expects of us. We are strive to put the leavening out of our homes just as we put the sin out of our lives. Well, those of you that like titles, the title of today's message is Your Wellness Plan. Your Wellness Plan. 3 months ago, right at the beginning of a counseling class at the university, the professor put a statement up on the overhead projector, and the statement was simply this: where there is no counsel, the people fail, the people fall. But in the multitude of counselors, there's safety. Then the professor asked if anyone in the class knew where that statement came from. Well, I waited, and I gazed around the room. There were 16 graduate students, most of them destined to become professional counselors. And seeing that no one else raised their hand in the awkward silence, I volunteered the answer, that it was from the book of Proverbs in the Bible. The professor seemed stunned for a moment, perhaps that anyone answered at all, and the class was unusually silent. I felt a few odd looks coming in my direction, and the professor asked me when the statement was written, and I said, oh, about 3,000 years ago. The professor then picked up the cue and went on to say that counselors have been around a long time, and that counsel is an essential part of wellness. That's a counselor's job, to help people enhance their sense of well-being. Now, of course, my thoughts ran to other proverbs besides Proverbs 11:14 that he had quoted up on the screen, which was the quote about being safety in a multitude of counselors. And then, but also came to mind Proverbs 15:22, and that is, without counsel, plans go awry, but in the multitude of counselors, they are established. In other words, if you don't get wise counsel, things don't always work out the way we want them to, if we just listen to ourselves without bouncing it off of a counselor. So we seek counselors to get advice, to make sure that our thoughts and ideas will turn out the way we want them to. And when we share our concerns with our counselors, then those counselors bear some of our burdens. A counselor must learn to deal with the burdens placed upon him or her from anyone who asks for help. Well, as part of the university counseling course, the professor who has spent about 40 years as a counselor, in addition to being a professor for the last umpty years, required all of his students to write a paper about personal wellness. He explained that a counselor cannot help other people unless the counselor himself or herself is keenly aware of what it takes to keep the self healthy, to keep yourself well, and that taking on all of the stresses of other people's lives will invariably take a toll on our own life. So accordingly, we must put our own lives in order. Therefore, he said, we should all look in the mirror every morning and see ourselves as we really are, warts and all. Of course, this is an uncomfortable subject. When we look inwardly, it's always easier to look at someone else and point out his or her faults. Those are easy to see. But as church members, we know that we are expected to examine ourselves regularly, and especially as we come into this Passover season and the week of unleavened bread. After all, this time is a time of self-examination and of purging out of sin, represented by the leavening, and then purifying our lives. In a sense, we're all to become counselors. We're all to be ready to help others to bear one another's burdens. In Revelation 5:10, here is what some of our destiny is. In Revelation 5:10, and it's speaking what God has destined for us. And I'm just, and it's a short verse in Revelation 5:10, and has made us to our God kings and priests, and we shall reign on earth. In other words, a destiny is when God's kingdom comes, we are to be kings and priests, as God said, in this world, in his coming kingdom. Well, what do kings and priests do? They bear one another's burdens. If you think about it, the king has the burden of a nation on his shoulders. The priests are those who bear the burden of carrying out what God expects of them in their duties and in helping others. If we turn to Galatians 6:2, we're instructed likewise to do this, just as our destiny is to being kings and priests. In Galatians 6 and verse 2, we're instructed to bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. So this is a responsibility that the Apostle Paul wrote when he instructed us to bear one another's burdens. And he wrote again in the book of Romans in chapter 15, in verse 1, in Romans 15 and 1. And we then that are strong ought to bear the infirmities of the weak, and not just to please ourselves. In other words, there's a responsibility that each of us has to be able to help others, to help bear their burdens. Now, of course, when we say this, we recognize that God has truly lifted the burden of sin from us. That was what Passover was about, and understanding God, through the sacrifice of Christ, lifted that burden of sin from us, the penalty of that sin. Let's turn to Exodus 6 in verse 6. In Exodus 6:6, therefore say to the children of Israel, I am the Eternal. I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will rescue you from their bondage, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgments. The next verse, Exodus 6:7, I will take you as my people, and I will be your God, and you shall know that I am the Eternal your God, who brings you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. So God was the one that lifted the children of Israel from their burdens of being in slavery in Egypt. And so we know ultimately God is to do that burden, but as we read from the apostles' writings, that we are to help bear one another's burdens and to be strong so that we can help those who are less so. Well, that's by way of introduction to the subject of bearing another's burdens and the counseling profession, of which we are all either now or someday to be participants in. In the year 2000, an academic group of counselors came up with a concept of what they call the Wheel of Wellness Counseling for Wellness, a holistic model for treatment planning, which was a big mouthful. And I had to read this very interesting paper, because it was what mankind said, this is how you're going to have to, how you can help people. In other words, because people are complex. They didn't use the words an onion, but they used the word of wheel and said it was an orb. And I thought, it's very much, people are very much like an onion. There are many layers to them. It's complex. If you cut them, somebody cries. I mean, there's a lot of things that go together with that model. And they had this model together where they were explaining about what some major life choices were. And I thought this was interesting enough that they could have as much of an organization of the truth absent the knowledge of God. The objective then of the wellness model was to help both counselors and their clients have more joy in their lives. Let's turn for a moment to Proverbs 12 and verse 20. In Proverbs 12 and verse 20, and it's we're breaking into a thought here, but deceit is in the heart of those who devise evil. But notice the second half of Proverbs 12:20. But counselors of peace have joy. What a delightful thought. There's one direction that we can go of deceit and evil, and then there's another direction. A counselor of peace has joy. Now, we all have our own definitions of joy. Some of us like to frolic through the tulips singing wonderful songs, and it's a great thought, you know, just an ethereal thought. But then there are daily practical things that we can do that will enhance our well-being so that we feel and we feel productive and helpful for others. So each of our definitions of what makes us joyful may be slightly different. And after all, then, if we think about it, a happy, well-adjusted counselor is more likely to be in a good position to help others, bearing in mind that since we are all to become those counselors and we're all to be working at bearing one another's burdens now, it means that we should do our best to become a counselor of peace, and then our reward, obviously, is listed here. It's joy. They have joy. Well, as this particular model goes, this wellness model that these professors have developed, have five major life tasks. So they've divided up the major life tasks. If you're going to analyze your life, you can fit everything, according to them, into five categories, and I found it useful. I've also found it quite interesting which one they placed first. The first life task they define as spirituality. Now, let me read you the definition they use of spirituality, which wasn't half bad. An awareness of a being or force that transcends the material aspects of life and gives a deep sense of wholeness or connectedness to the universe. They were trying to speak to what people, how they define spirituality absent the knowledge of God, which is difficult to do. So this is about as good a definition as you're going to get, absent the knowledge of the true God. So an awareness of a being or force that transcends the material aspects of life and gives a deep sense of wholeness or connectedness to the universe. So in other words, people continually have a desire or a feeling, kind of a universal desire around the world to understand what something is, a greater power than themselves. We see religions around the world, Hinduism, Islam, Taoism, animism, voodoo, pantheism, Buddhism, and many more, including people who participate in what I call churchianity, the people who go to church for social reasons and pursue a social gospel. They all seek some connectedness to the universe in one way or another, yet many of them simply do not follow the true God. In Psalm 14:1, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God, they're corrupt, they have done abominable works, there is none that does good. In other words, he's referring in this psalm to those who then deny the existence of God. If they say there is no God, God has an opinion about that, and his opinion reigns, that they have done abominable works, and they cannot do good, that is corrupt if you deny the existence of God. So the result of the world's spiritual thinking is not good. And we're fortunate that we have some knowledge of the plan of God, and those spring holy days that we now experience are instrumental in guiding our understanding. So the first life task is spirituality. So if you can ask yourself, where am I on my decision-making process, or where am I as far as my well-being with regard to your spirituality? And I have pretty confident that the people in this room would rate themselves as confident in knowing what they believe and why they believe it, or, of course, you would not be here. So this is a big life task for a counselor to look at themselves, to evaluate themselves, and then for the counselor to ask people to, their clients, to evaluate themselves. So, and there are many people who are unsettled. After all, we have the example of the pearl of great price who was being sought by a merchant. In other words, people are seeking. They're seeking the truths of God. And so they're seeking. They're looking to find that knowledge. And so there are many people that are just, and that's why they stumble into these many other religions, because they're looking for something, and many are not quite sure what they've found or when they find it, or they go on seeking or get misled. So the first task, life task spirituality, is we should rate ourselves on in a scale of 1 to 10. Where are we? How comfortable are we on our scale of 1 to 10? How much faith do we have in our faith? How much confidence do we have that we know what God has presented and has shown us? The next life category, or life task category, the second life task these counselor professors have outlined, is self-direction. And that's probably the biggest one that we'll look at today. And they define self-direction as the manner in which an individual regulates, disciplines, and directs the self in daily activities in pursuit of long-range goals. So far, so good. The patterns of behavior and methods of adjustment to life that make up self-direction are sometimes referred to as positive personality traits to give one a stress-resistant personality. Well, that certainly sounds good. I'd like a stress-resistant personality. In other words, how strong is our self-direction? For a counselor to help others, a counselor must have a strong personal sense of self-direction. Now, in this category, they list a dozen areas of self-direction. So we're going to take a quick look. I'm not going to look through verses for every one of them, or we would use up Mr. Mann's 20 minutes that he's allocated for this afternoon. Maybe a bit more. But we will go through them. In other words, and what I'd like you to do is, in your own mind or on paper, whatever you wish, is to rate yourself. Where am I, with a number 10 being very strong and a number 1 being very weak? And these are all under the life task 2 categories of self-direction. Under the letter A, I have sense of self-worth. What is your sense of self-worth? That you're okay with yourself. You're comfortable in your own skin. Your sense of self-worth on a scale of 1 to 10. Some people have great troubles in this area. Had a student the other day in senior high school who expressed those concerns to me, and looking for some direction. Many people simply don't have the confidence or a sense of self-worth. The letter B, I have sense of control. How would you rate your life under sense of control? Is your life mostly under control, pretty much a 10, or is it closer, mostly out of control, and a 1? And we can all rate ourselves somewhere along the way as to where we are in that sense of control. Do things sort of happen the way you want them to, and you're comfortable with that, or is there room for improvement? The letter C I have is realistic beliefs. Now, we were asked to rate ourselves, and indeed I went through all of this and wrote a self-analysis paper rating myself in each of these categories. And I can only wonder what the professor really thought when I expressed my confidence in realistic beliefs, that after all, we are fortunate to be able to look out at the world, and given the knowledge that God has gifted to us, not that we have earned, but we've been chosen, and God has gifted to us an awareness of what the world is, what our destiny is, and what's our comfort level with understanding that, bearing in mind that many people don't really know. And that's very awkward for many, particularly in the university world, who have great difficulty sorting through what's real and what's not. The letter D, then, the letter D is emotional awareness. Emotional awareness. This is somewhat awkward for me. I know I've taken, and you may have heard of the Myers-Briggs type indicator that rates people, introvert or extrovert, and intuitive or a sensitive. There's four categories, a thinker or a feeler, and then a perceiver or a judger. In each of those four categories, people can rate themselves on a scale from one end to the other. And so emotional awareness, the feelers have it all over the thinkers because they have an antenna up and they can sense like a radar dish that's looking around. They can take it from all directions. And then those of us, according to the feelers who are unfortunate enough to be thinkers, have to stop and think about it. Well, let's see, incoming missile at 10 o'clock. Oh, yes! It's more difficult to see for a thinker to see some of the emotions, to feel them quickly, and we have to make effort to do that. So emotional awareness is a category that some people have as a better gift than others, and others have to work on it. So what do you rate yourself as? Aware of yourself and your own needs, your own emotional awareness, or the needs of others? What is your comfort level for emotional awareness? And then we go to the letter E. Now, this one I really, really like. Boy, this was right up my alley. The letter E, problem solving. And you can throw creativity onto that. Although problem solving, and this is often looked at as a male trait because males historically, as anecdotally, tend to be less emotionally aware and more focused on problem solving. I know I have to ask my wife, do you want an answer to the question, or do you just want me to comfort you with this particular challenge? I'm not sure. And so there are, and then she will let me know, hopefully. But the problem solving is something that many people are hired to do. They're hired to solve problems, and that is their function. Now, many jobs don't require you to solve problems. Something comes down the conveyor belt, you do the thing to it, whatever you do, and it moves on. Other jobs are complex. I have a brother who works at a huge, one of the biggest name manufacturers in America, and I ask him, what is your job really? And it's in a huge manufacturing plant, the largest of its type in the world. In fact, and he is the guy in charge of solving problems in a sense that he described his job as the triage nurse, telling which children in the emergency room would not get treated. Of course, the context was in a manufacturing sense, no, your machine and assembly will not be repaired because the priorities are somewhere else. So he was dealing all day, every day, essentially as an industrial triage nurse, solving problems, regardless of how people felt about the prioritization. And some people are gifted at it, and some people are not as strong in that area. The letter F, sense of humor. How is your sense of humor? Do you have a wide sense of humor that can laugh at almost anything? Some people have a very narrow sense that not much is funny. And then some have a very wide sense where things that are funny really shouldn't be. It gets a little bit wide. And then some people have a rather deep sense of humor, and they just can't stop laughing once it gets started. They will quit. Others, I remember the minister in Fargo, North Dakota, many years ago. He explained, and of course to those of you, and if anyone from Fargo is listening some to this on the tape, bear in mind I used to attend there and I'm from that region. So I understand it well. And he said, I always get good mileage out of any joke that I tell. He said, there's always three occasions when people laugh. The first time, he says, they laugh out of courtesy because that's what you're supposed to do. He said, the second one is they laugh because somebody else laughed, and therefore, following up on that. And then he said, they laugh the third time when they actually get the joke. But he said, otherwise it's pretty dry, and sometimes they don't get it right away. I remember from time to time he would ask me, was anybody actually listening today? Did anybody actually hear it? And, of course, that society or that culture in that area is less expressive emotionally. But the sense of humor may be there, but it isn't expressed. So how do you rate your sense of humor in your own wellness analysis. Or is that something that you want to work on? Now I have the letter G in my list, and I have nutrition. Now, nutrition is an interesting, it's a little different for each one of us. Each one of our bodies is built a little differently, and as a result, our nutritional needs are a little different, and they are different when we're infants, when we need milk, as when we're adults and we can handle more foods. And so nutrition, where are we on our own nutritional balance? Do we have a strong sense of what our needs are? Or is that an area that we need work on? I know in my own self, I've had many years to ignore the problems that were building within me, and then all of a sudden one day they start catching up. And then it still took many years to figure out a particular nutritional area. Then the letter H is exercise. Of course, those often go together, nutrition and exercise. And the exercise, again, for every person is different. Some people have congenital issues from birth that will not allow certain levels of exercise. Other people have different preferences. Some people would rather eat a bar of soap than go running, and they will do something else. I would rather, but then it has to do with, some congenital foot issues, but I can bounce on a trampoline a lot easier than I can go running because it's easier on my system. But everybody has their strengths. What is your strength in that area? How would you rate yourself? Then there's the letter I. It's called self-care. And in self-care, interestingly enough, statistically, women do such a much better job of self-care. And that's why married men live longer. Their women take care of them, generally speaking, and single men don't make it as long as them. And women outlive men altogether by an average of 7 years. So self-care is an issue for people. And how well do you look after yourself? Where do you rate yourself on that scale from 10 being the highest and 1 being the lowest? And then there's an issue of stress management. How do you rate yourself on stress management? Some people can't deal with it at all. Some people just shut down. I have sheep at home, and they're a wilder than usual sheep. They're a black-bellied Barbados, a threatened species, originally from North Africa and then from the Barbados Islands in the Caribbean. And they jump like deer, so when I read the song about the leaping like lambs, I can see them jumping. But they're very flighty and very jumpy. And it takes some time to calm and settle down. But so if I get them penned up, and if I've sold an animal, and if I put my hands on it, they will drop to the ground. They give up. They just freeze it. They can't handle the stress. It's just too much for them. And they just quit. They're just over with. That's how they deal with the stress. How do we deal with the stress? Some people do it explosively. Some people are very methodical about it. But each one of us has our own levels of stress management. A number of years ago, I did talk to a lady who was a psychologist in the church, and she was showing us that how some people react to distressful situations. And she had some kind of test, and I haven't looked it up since, but it's whether how you do in stormy conditions as compared to, you know, calm conditions. And it's interesting when you put people through an analysis, whether they spike up and get very excitable first, and whether they stay that way, or whether they calm slowly, and some people ramp up very slowly, and finally they blow up at the end. And so everybody has their own scale of stress management. Then there's only a couple categories left, and they're on our dozen sub-list here. Gender identity. Now, for most part, I don't think we have any problem with that. Apparently, there's some problem with that at the university level. We just looked at Deuteronomy 22:5 and a few other verses, and says a man ought to look like a man and a woman ought to look like a woman, and we ought to be fairly comfortable with that. So K is gender identity. And then L, the last one, is cultural identity. I was raised in the North. My wife was raised of Southern parents, so there's a slight cultural difference there. She mispronounces all the words that I think are perfectly normal. And so there's some issues that we have had to deal with, and we've resolved that by putting a dictionary on each side of the bed. I keep several of mine in case my dictionary is incomplete and it agrees with hers. I can have an extra dictionary or three till I find the definition and pronunciation that I want. But sometimes there's those issues to deal with. So how do we rate ourselves? Are we strong or comfortable in our skin with regard to cultural identity? So anyway, that was life task number two on self-direction. Then rate yourself on life task number three. These will be much shorter. Work and leisure. Now, we've got three choices in life. We can go through a ton of verses in the Bible about, you know, work with, you know, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might and so forth. But the three choices in life with regard to work and leisure is you can live where you want to live. You can make the kind of money you want to make, or you can do what you want to do. You can live where you want to live, make the kind of money you want to make, or you can do what you want to do. Very few people get to do all three. Some people get to do two of them. More people get to do one of them, but an amazing number of people don't get any of those three things and will live a life of frustration because they don't live where they want to live, they don't make the kind of money they want to make, and they don't do what they want to do. So how do you rate yourself in your life task of work and leisure? That's life task number three. And life task number four, friendship. Many years ago, I moved to an area and went to a church with a congregation of about 400 people. Yet I found myself lonely because I didn't have a close friend. I prayed to God that He would deliver to me a friend. I was involved in every activity that I could in the church. Spokesman's Club, the moving crew, going on outings, taking my kids to activities, and so forth. And I developed acquaintances. Yet I didn't feel as though I had a really, truly close friend. And years went by, and I was exasperated. And then one day it hit me. I developed a best friend, and I hadn't even realized it. The friendship simply grew a bit by bit over the years. In Proverbs 18:24, we're all reminded that a man who has friends must himself be friendly, but there's a friend who sticks closer than a brother. So, and I thought of that, and I read that verse to myself. Well, I've got to be friendly if you're going to have a friend. And then I realized, you know, the Bible does speak about friends, and this is a major life task. And let's look at James chapter 2 and verse 23. In James 2 and verse 23, and the scripture was fulfilled which says, Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness, and he was called the friend of God. Can you imagine being called the friend of God? Well, that's what we are if we keep the commandments of Jesus Christ. We can turn further then to John 15 and verse 12. We read this briefly at Passover. In John 15 and verse 12. So in Proverbs, we know that we must, to have a friend, we must show ourselves friendly. James, it says that Abraham was a friend of God. And then in John 15, verse 12, starting in verse 12, this is my commandment. Notice that Abraham believed God. And, of course, if you believe God, you're going to follow His commandments. And so John 15, verse 12, this is my commandment, that you love one another as I've loved you. Greater love has no one than this, than to lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do whatsoever I command you. Let's remember Abraham there. No longer do I call you servants, for a servant does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends. For all the things I've heard from my Father, I've made known to you. So we must show ourselves friendly. Abraham was a friend of God, and Jesus Christ declares us to be his friend, that he is our friend. And it's up to us then, will we accept the friendship of Jesus Christ. So on our life task of friendship, how would we rate ourselves with regard to being a friend, whether it's a friend of God or a friend of others? There is a little nuance to that in Proverbs also in 16:28. Will you let anyone come between you and your friend, Jesus Christ? In Proverbs 16:28, a perverse man sows strife, and a whisperer separates the best of friends. Well, this is an interesting, because if you listen to the whisperer, a whisperer will indeed try to separate you from your relationship with Jesus Christ, or even with your friends on earth. Revelation 3:11 sums that concept up very quickly. In Revelation 3:11, when Jesus Christ is saying, "Behold, I come quickly, and hold fast that which you have, that no man take your crown." So remember that proverb in 16:28, that don't let anyone separate you from the best of friends. Jesus Christ is your best of friend. And that you must hold fast that which you have, that no one can take your crown. The task number 5, so we've rated ourselves on friendship. Task number 5 is love. Everybody needs love. There are studies showing how much better a baby thrives if they're held closely, when they have skin-to-skin contact, when they're talked to, when they're sung to, and their needs are attended to. Staying close to God is a prerequisite for staying close to each other. Let's take a look at Deuteronomy 7:9. I'm only going to look at a couple of areas here. In Deuteronomy 7:9, "Know therefore that the Eternal your God, He is God, the faithful God, which keeps covenant and mercy with them that love Him and keep His commandments to 1,000 generations. 1,000 generations is a long time. It's an expression of forever. So, we now know Abraham was a friend of God. Jesus Christ is our best friend. And we are friends if we do what Christ says, whatever he commands us to do. And we read now in Deuteronomy that our relationship with God will last, not just for us, but for generations to come. And then we turn to 1 John 5:2. We're very close to it when we're in near the end of the Bible, very close to the end, near next to Revelation. In 1 John 5:2, verses 2 and 3. "By this we know that we love the children of God when we love God and keep His commandments." Verse 3, "For this is the love of God, that we keep His commandments, and His commandments are not grievous." So God is going to be faithful and merciful to us and to those who keep His commandments for 1,000 generations. And then when we love God and we love the children of God and keep His commandments, this is the love of God. Well, how will people know if we love God and keep His commandments? Now the book of John, not 1 John, but the book of John 13, and verse 35, it's a simple verse. John 13:35. "By this shall all men know that you are my disciples, if you have love to one another." That's how we know. If God knows if we love God and keep His commandments, because we're expressing that in love to one another. So how did we rate ourselves? Of the 5 major life tasks, how did we rate ourselves in spirituality? How much faith do we have in our faith on a 1 to 10 basis? Do we rate ourselves a 10, or are we a lower number? On the life task number 2, under self-direction, how do we rate ourselves on our sense of worth, our sense of control, our realistic beliefs, our emotional awareness, our problem-solving and creativity, our sense of humor, our nutrition, our exercise, our self-care, our stress management, our gender identity and cultural identity? Under life task 3, how do we rate ourselves in our work and leisure activities? Are we at a 10 or at some other, or at a 1 or at some somewhere in between? On life task number 4, on friendship, where do we rate ourselves? I know during the fall holy day on the Day of Atonement work, it's called atonement because we are to be at one with God. So how's our friendship level with God? Is Jesus Christ our best friend? Do we let other people come in between us and our friends, whether it's God the Father, Jesus Christ, or our worldly friends? And then life task number 5 is love, whether it's love for God, love for His work, love for His ways, love for His commandments, love for our family and our friends. If you analyze the major subtasks or the major tasks in the list of subtasks, and you look in the mirror and you rate yourself on how well you're doing in each of those areas, and the question becomes, and the question of the day, and if it were on one of these game shows, they would say, drum roll, please. The question of the day is, what are you doing about it? How well are we in tune with God and ourselves? And this is where each one of us can develop a personal wellness plan. Now that we've rated ourselves in each category, we can decide what do we want to do in each category to be a better person. And as the Apostle Paul instructed us in Ephesians 4 in verse 22. In Ephesians 4 and verse 22. That you put off concerning your former conduct the old man which grows corrupt according to the deceitful lusts, verse 23, and be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and that you put on the new man which was created according to God in true righteousness and holiness. I would submit that Ephesians 4, verse 22, is the ultimate goal of a wellness plan. After all, a goal is nothing but a dream with a plan and a deadline. And so if you have a goal that's fed, listed, you know, you've had your dream, you've got a plan to do something about it, and there's a deadline, you've got a goal. And of course, this ultimate wellness plan is to follow the commandments of God, to be renewed by the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, to change from our former way of doing things that we just read in Ephesians, and put on the new man to become a person of righteousness and holiness. So as we begin our week of unleavened bread, let us all each ask ourselves privately in our hearts, what is our wellness plan?